You're listening to a City on a Hill podcast. We'd love you to use and share this podcast, but please refrain from editing the content without permission from City on a Hill. If you'd like to know more about our church, or if you'd like to donate to the work of City on a Hill, please visit cityonahill.com.au.
Today's Bible reading is from Esther chapter 8. Esther chapter 8, verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Then Esther spoke again to the king. She fell at his feet and wept and pleaded with him to avert the evil plan of Haman the Agagite and the plot that he had devised against the Jews. When the king held out the golden scepter to Esther, Esther rose and stood before the king, and she said, "If it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and if the thing seems right before the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the provinces of the king. For how can I bear to see the calamity that is coming to my people? Or how can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred?" Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows, because he intended to lay hands on the Jews. But you may write as you please with regards to the Jews in the name of the king and seal it with the king's ring. For an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked." The king's scribes were summoned at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day. And an edict was written according to all that Mordecai commanded concerning the Jews, to the satraps and the governors and the officials of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, and to each province in its own script and to each people in its own language, and also to the Jews in their script and their language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring. Then he sent the letters by mounted couriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud, saying that the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed forces of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. On one day, throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, a copy of what was written was to be issued as a decree in every province, being publicly displayed to all peoples, and the Jews were to be ready on that day to take vengeance on their enemies. So the couriers mounted on their swift horses that were used in the king's service, rode out hurriedly, urged by the king's command. And the decree was issued in Susa the citadel. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a great golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen on them. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Well, hello. Have you ever met me before? My name is Coy. I'm the associate pastor here. It's so good to see you in this lovely, bright Sunday morning. Now, in February 1979, a man named Barry Bremen, an insurance and novelty goods salesman in the U.S., from the U.S., donned a Kansas City Kings uniform during an NBA All-Star game, which is the basketball league over there. He had no connection to this team, nor was he an athlete. In July that year, he dressed as a New York Yankee. He wore the uniform and joined the baseball team on the field in the All-Star game, even taking group photos with all the future Hall of Famers in baseball. He was not an athlete or a New York Yankee. In December that year, he posed as a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader at a Cowboys game, even losing 10 kilos and learning the drag routines with his wife while wearing a blonde wig. He's not a cheerleader or part of the Dallas Cowboys. But this Bremen gentleman, 5 years on, he would play, he would join a basketball league. He would go and play in the NBA, dress up as an NBA player. He'd go to a baseball game, dress up as a baseball player. He even went and pretended to be an umpire at a hockey game. He was none of these things. He actually became quite famous and was known in folklore, a bit of a legend, and his name was the Great Imposter. And you can see why, right? Talk about commitment from this guy. He just kept getting kicked out of these sport games that he didn't belong, and he just kept doing it year after year for a decade. Well, we're in our second to last week in the book of Esther, a story which has encapsulated the wonderful providence of God, how he is a sovereign God who undoubtedly fulfills his promises. And we've seen how God used the main characters in the story so far, with Esther and her cousin Mordecai, prominent figures in the salvation of the Jewish people, next to this powerful enemy, this ruthless Persian king and his right-hand man, Haman, who wanted to annihilate the entire people group, the Jewish people, a plan that was foiled by God, as God would not allow it to happen, would not allow the end of the Jewish people whom he had promised generations ago would be delivered by his hand. So last week, we looked at what many saw as the peak of the story, where Haman got his just desserts, you know, having the plans for evil reversed on him. He was put to death and dishonored, while Esther and her people were given life and honored. It's been a story of God's faithfulness and his victory over those who oppose him. Now, something else that stands out from reading today's passage is that this is a story that depicts the enduring commitment of God and his people, that Esther, Mordecai, God himself displays such a resolute dedication to their people, which is what I want to open with today, that in the book of Esther, we see the beauty of their commitment. Because what sets up the emphasis on commitment is that both Esther and Mordecai have gone through a lot to get to where they are right now, with Haman no longer here. But while the immediate threat of Haman was no longer here, was gone, the threat of their people's annihilation was still present. So what we see is a real commitment to their people, a real concerted effort to ensure that the Jewish people's story didn't end there. It's like what every action movie says that loves to say, like, we didn't come this far just to die. And we see this commitment from Esther in verse 3, where she again goes to the king to speak to him, this time falling at his feet and pleading with him to avert the evil plans of Haman. Even though Queen Esther was in a position where she was looked upon favorably by King Xerxes after the events that have transpired over the last few chapters, she again risks her life by going into his presence unrequested. You know, sure, she's in the king's good books at the moment, you know, but we know that this king could be a bit of a mad king who could have just as easily had a bad day, you know, or had grown tiresome. He could have been tired of Esther coming to keep making these requests, just as Xerxes had done previously in chapter 1, where he just like banished his queen Vashti, a bit of a mad king. But Esther, with great commitment to the salvation of her people, risks her life again to ask for the king's aid in changing the decree. Because what we need to know is that in those days, when a king makes a decree such as this, it's essentially an ironclad guarantee, meaning it can't be broken or taken back. The king would be at risk of undercutting his authority and making him look weak. But it does reveal to you the commitment of Xerxes, the king, in light of all that's happened. Because last chapter, he did show some care at the thought of losing his queen because of this decree, you know, but we can sense that his anger against it wasn't really about the thought of the entire Jewish people being destroyed, but it was more so about his ego, you know, that Haman, his confidant, his second in charge, had manipulated him and hurt his pride. And so it's reflected here in his response of not reversing the decree. It's as theologian Ben P. Wallace says of the decree still being followed. He says, Xerxes was saying to the queen, you and Mordecai find a way out of this. I cannot lose face. And that was precisely what they did with his authority. See, the king had no real commitment to the Jewish people. And why would he? He was ready to annihilate them just the day before Esther was pleading to him. So his bravado in front of Esther previously was not so sincere. And you can see the differences between the King Xerxes here and Queen Esther. The king sits there kind of sheepishly shrugging his shoulders like, what can be done about this decree? You know, that's a shame. Well, the king risks her life again, pleading with the king to revoke this decree to save the Jews. She shows a great commitment to her people. While that evil instigator Haman was no longer in the way, as we heard last week, the outcome was still actually the same, though, if nothing was changed. But because of her pleading with Xerxes, something was done. The king saw her passion, her dedication, her commitment, her desperation to her people. So the king gives her and Mordecai a resolution that in the decree, they could add onto it whatever they liked. They could essentially issue a counter decree, which they did. And I'll go into that a bit more in my next point. But notice now that the king was issuing permission for Mordecai to make changes to the king's edict, which was a huge position to have, to think there was only like a day or two's difference from Mordecai likely being executed. He was on death row essentially, to now sitting next to the king and queen making ironclad decrees across the nation himself. It's a massive turnaround in such a short amount of time. See, Mordecai was essentially now the prime minister, the second in charge, taken over from Haman, who initially wanted Mordecai dead. This would have seemed impossible to imagine just a few chapters earlier, you know, from death row to royal robes. And as we've been seeing all throughout the book, you know, this turnaround can only be attributed to the God who was with them. But here we're going to focus on the commitment of Esther and Mordecai in particular to want to save their people. It all began with Mordecai's plea all the way back in chapter 4. And now we see the fruits from that. We think of Queen Esther, who in this story has shown amazing character development. She started out hesitant, not wanting to be much part of this decree that was set on her people, but has since then risked her life multiple times to ensure her people are saved. She, in great wisdom, used her smarts to expose Haman. We heard that last week, ending their greatest threat. She, a queen, pleads to a king, you know, knowing that he was the one with power to change things, lowering herself to raise up others. We essentially see Esther move to like a legend status in real time. As a woman, in her courage and faith, she delivers an entire people, which is why she's still so celebrated in the Jewish faith and the Jewish culture. We also see the great commitment of her cousin Mordecai, who with great determination and faith put all the things in motion with his pleas to Esther back in chapter 4. And now he's being the one that would rise up the ranks of power, meaning more security for his people. Now, as he's now honored by the king, he's given authority and power, so much so that he, Mordecai, would be the one who writes the counter decree that would protect all his people. See, what we see from these two is this enduring commitment to their people. Such their commitment, you can see just how celebrated they were by their people. In verse 15 to 16, it says, the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen on them. See, their commitment had reverberations across the land, that even those who weren't God's people were wanting to be that. It's quite a sight to see, and one that does encourage us and challenge us as Christians today. Do we share the same commitment to God's people today? So even though Mordecai and Esther were committed because God's people were in a dire situation with their lives literally on the line, there's a sense that we too, as Christians, should be committed to God's people just the same, even if it isn't as extreme. See, we hear of countless missionaries who go to the ends of the earth to proclaim the gospel of Jesus, some who actually do risk their lives even today. How might you be able to commit to them? Perhaps financially, perhaps prayerfully, or maybe a little closer to home. Brothers and sisters who volunteer their time to local ministries such as uni ministries, street evangelism, school chaplains. Our own Esther Fan, who's from our church, has a backpackers ministry where those traveling around the world, they come here and are exposed to the gospel of Jesus. How might you be able to commit to them? Perhaps with your presence or words of encouragement. Or even closer than that, even closer to home, your church, where your brother or sister by your side is perhaps here for the first time or the 100th time, where the person across from you is struggling with some things in their life and maybe need the support of love and help and accountability, where the person behind you desires to know Jesus more, craves to know what the gospel is all about. How can you be committed to them? Perhaps by your hospitality, your friendship, perhaps by you joining a gospel community. See, commitment today can be a hard thing because we live in a time where commitment seems to be sort of like a dirty word. You know, more people are opting for shorter phone plans. You know, plenty of people are changing jobs. Less people are getting married. But the Bible shows us the importance of commitment to our fellow believers. Like the early church in Acts, who in chapter 2 says they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship. Seeing it as important to be committed to one another for the purposes of the gospel. Or the Apostle Paul in the New Testament, who lived and walked in the steps of his Lord Jesus, truly loving God's people like they were his children. In Philippians 1, he says, "For God is my witness, how I yearn for you all with the affection of Jesus Christ." He loved his people so much. He was committed to them, always committed to them for the sake of the gospel. See, Esther, being the queen of Persia, living in a palace, would have been quite distant from the everyday happenings and ongoings of her people in Susa. Yet she shows her commitment to her people for the sake of the Lord, which is what it can be like for us. We may be praying or giving towards ministries or missions to people we don't even know, but we're showing faithfulness to God by being committed to his people in our support nonetheless. There's a sense of family, a sense of camaraderie when we do it, you know, like we're all on the same team and we're working towards the same goal. Like any commitment, it will cost something. Time, money, resources, comfort, tough conversations. But like Esther and Mordecai, if it's a commitment that is centered on God, we can be sure that it's valuable. Like there's a couple at our church, Chris and Carla, who when we had a 4 p.m. service, they would always have an open invite for people after the 4 p.m. service to go and have a dinner at High Point, essentially. Anyone and everyone from church was invited almost every week. And they had weeks where they got nobody. They also had weeks where there were one-time visitors who were extremely challenging. And then they got weeks where it was an absolute joy. And then they got weeks where they started a friendship that led to a person recently coming to Christ. What an amazing example and encouragement they have been in their commitment to God's people. And just so in Esther, we see the faithful commitment of two prominent leaders of the Jewish people in this chapter. But while we see a clearly positive commitment, chapter 9 shows us a commitment that can be read as a little bit more grey, where some would say it even looks more like an over-commitment was achieved by God's people, which leads to my next point, the tension in their commitment. Now, there are a lot of great movies out there. I'm sure there are a lot of movie buffs around here, but one of my pet peeves, and perhaps a pet peeve for you as well, is the unnecessary sequel. You know, those movies that you just know they didn't need to make, you know, the sequels that ruined everything good about the first one, sequels that completely went a different direction from the first movie, sequels that were clearly just a Hollywood cash grab. Dennis the Menace, And then the sequel, Dennis the Menace strikes again. There was no need. Somebody, please, just discipline this kid. You know, just send him to his room. There's no sequel. And then you got the horror series, the thriller series, I Know What You Did Last Summer, which has three sequels. And the titles are actually the best. A bit on the nose. I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. I'll Always Know What You Did Last Summer. And the fourth one's coming out. I reckon it should be titled, I Am Tired of Knowing What You Did Last Summer. Or one of my favorites, the most unnecessary sequel out there, Titanic 2. All right, with a tagline that says, they said it couldn't happen twice. Yeah, because it didn't happen twice. All right. We don't like the unnecessary sequels because they often ruin good stories, makes the story feel too long. And many can actually see chapter 9 as that, where it feels like it's unnecessary to this amazing story that we've just witnessed. See, the good guys prevailed. The bad guy got his comeuppance. Esther helps get this decree to be changed. And Mordecai is raised up to this new second in charge. Like, wow, that would make a great ending. Done, boom. But the events that follow feel like they ruin that. Can feel like the narrative is now drawn out too long. That things happen which make us think a bit differently about the overall story. Because after Esther pleads to King Xerxes, he decides to let Mordecai issue a counter decree instead of revoking his law to have the Jews wiped out. To which Mordecai in verse 11 to 12 writes that the Jews were able to defend themselves against any who attack them and destroy their opposers for one day. See, this is a counter decree that would mean protection for the Jewish people, which all sounds good and well. The Jews across the land celebrated, it says at the end of chapter 8. But it's in chapter 9, after the counter decree is issued, that we actually read it played out. We see the counter decree in action. We read of the enemies of the Jews being defeated when going against the Jewish people. And it was a massacre. It says in verse 5 that the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them as they pleased to those who hated them. In verse 16, it says that the Jews in the king's provinces killed 75,000 of their enemies who hated them. That is a lot of people. And so to many readers, this is where we get a bit uncomfortable. Because while we've seen great commitment from Esther and Mordecai in the story to get them to where they are, some commentators have mentioned that chapter 9, it's almost like God's people had over-committed themselves, like doing things that were a bit too much. There's a tension that readers have to wrestle with now. See, we went from cheering them on in the narrative, like, yeah, go the Jewish people, go Esther, go Mordecai, to now squirming a bit in their actions. Look, they kind of look like they're Persian oppressors right now. It all seems a bit excessive. And to add to that, the fact that the counter decree included women and children makes it even more difficult for us as readers. That the Jews were given permission to defend themselves, even laying waste to the families of their oppressors. It's a confronting end as a narrative draws to a close. It feels unnecessary. This sort of over-commitment. But to understand these chapters like this, I think would be to misunderstand the context of Esther. This was Old Testament times, a very different time to today. And so that means in those days, God's people were still under Old Testament law, and the law was very intricate and detailed with plenty of principles and guidelines. Like you may be familiar with one of the principles from Old Testament law back then in Leviticus 24, which says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And why I pinpoint this law is because we have to remember that the decree written by Mordecai in chapter 8 was to counter that of which Haman initially issued in chapter 3, whereby Haman's decree, that edict, gave the instruction to all the king's provinces that they could destroy, annihilate the Jews, young and old women and children included, on one day. And so Mordecai, in his counter, writes up the exact same thing in reverse that goes back to the Jews' enemy. that the Jews can now defend themselves by doing the exact same thing back to them, which they had been instructed. So they're kind of parallel with one another, pretty much an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But that law of an eye for a tooth and a tooth wasn't meant to be a means of vengeance for God's people or some sort of unhinged revenge. But it's what pastor and author Alistair Begg says, that that principle was not about gaining unlimited retribution against an enemy, but it's about ensuring that punishment for a crime matches the damage done by the crime and doesn't supersede it. It's actually a protection from going over the top in retribution. And so while Mordecai's edict seems quite extreme, it was actually in line with everything exactly the same as Haman's, not superseding it. And something we need to also note is that while the counter decree allowed the attacking of women and children, as well as plundering their enemies, the author of Esther purposely notes that the Jews laid no hands on the plunder three times, they say. And the details of the enemies destroyed are described as men, all but once. With the other time where it's not mentioned as men, is just referred to a total of people. And so knowing this, it does kind of helpfully ease the moral problem of the passage that God's people were defending themselves, not instigating killings unprovoked, and that they didn't actually do anything that was outside of what they had permission to do. So the decree itself in those days was actually quite fair and understandable. But while that may be the case, Esther's actions also too seem to display a sort of overcommitment. Because once the day was done, where the Jews were able to defend themselves, Xerxes asked the queen if she had any other requests from verse 12 to 15. And we read that Queen Esther requests that they allow to have an extra day to do the exact same thing. And then with Haman's 10 sons already dead, she requests that their bodies be hung up and impaled on the stake for all to see. So the Jews killed another 300 men upon this extra day's request. Now, this sounds excessive. In fact, some commentators have downright described Esther here as bloodthirsty, like she demanded bloodshed. And so it's a bit uncomfortable for us as we have to wrestle with this kind of morally gray concept of holy war. That is where war is justified on the grounds of religious differences, in this case, God's people. We read of the violence and the bloodshed caused by God's people, the excessiveness even of Esther, and wonder if it contradicts what the New Testament teaches us about loving our enemies as ourselves. But to grasp the reality of what Esther and the Jews do here would mean we have to remember a few things that we've actually already talked about throughout this series. For instance, the importance of the Jews in Persia actually surviving. Because had the decree not been countered, it would mean a historically tragic end to God's redemptive work in human history. God's promises of delivering his people would have not been achieved. His salvation would not have happened. It says, a theologian Karen Jobe says, if this counter decree that included such violence did not happen, it would have signaled God's abandonment to sin of not only his people Israel, but all humanity. So the need for bloodshed in God's people defending themselves is justified there, you know, only doing what was necessary to survive. But that doesn't answer the excessiveness shown by Esther's request. And for that, we have to remember what was talked about in last week's sermon on chapter 7, where I talked about Haman's connection to his ancestor Agag, an Amalekite, and Mordecai, who was an ancestor of King Saul. And as you might remember, I talked about how Mordecai was essentially a second Saul, able to do what Saul could not do all those generations earlier, because the Amalekites were the first enemies of God, God's people. Sorry, they were the first enemies of God's people after the Exodus. They were trying to destroy the Israelites. And so God had commanded Saul wipe them out, every single one of them, promising them destruction for opposing his chosen people in Deuteronomy 25, to which Saul didn't do, sparing their leader Agag, which led to Haman's family line. Hence, it says, if you look in that book of Esther, it says Haman was called an Agagite. He came from the line of Agag, the man that Saul, let live. And so with that in mind, what's important to note is the wording of Haman's decree against the Jews, because it actually echoes the Lord's words to King Saul, given through the prophet Samuel in 1 Samuel 15, which says this: "Thus says the Lord of hosts, I've noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." And these words from God reflected his ancient promise even a fair ways back before that to Israel, where in Exodus chapter 17, verse 14, it says this: "Then the Lord says to Moses, write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, the Lord is my banner, saying, a hand upon the throne of the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." And so as we can see, the Amalekites as a people, whether man, woman, or children, were the quintessential enemies of God's people in biblical theology. And so what Haman did in attempting to issue his decree of death against the Jews, Haman was trying to reverse the decree of destruction that was meant for him and his people that God had promised their enemies, the Amalekites. Haman had tried to turn around that destiny of destruction onto God's people, the Jews. But as we saw, Mordecai changes that. Karen Job saying, Mordecai's decree reverses Haman's and therefore turns that promise of destruction back onto the enemies of the Jews who were seeking to destroy them. It's all starting to sound like one long running like Uno game, right? Where Amalek drops like a draw two, and then Israel drops a draw two, and then Haman drops a reverse, and then finally, you know, Mordecai drops a reverse card on that. But what it's showing to us is that Mordecai's decree actually echoes the command of God himself all the way back, who all throughout the Old Testament has declared a holy war on the enemies of his people, that he promised to completely wipe out Amalek for trying to destroy Israel, his chosen people. And so Esther requested that extra day of bloodshed, as well as Haman's sons to be shamefully impaled. That was a reflection of God's command from all the ways back, from those who oppose God will be utterly destroyed. But it all does sound a little barbaric still. And perhaps instead of making you question Esther's actions now, it actually makes you question God's. Like, is God that vengeful, wrathful, tyrannical God that he's often painted? One who demands blood, violence, and punishment to those who oppose him? Is he really like what well-known atheist Richard Dawkins described of him, that the God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction, jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser, misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, malevolent bully? And you can understand why Richard or many others would come to this conclusion. We read in the Bible the countless people, cities, nations, which are wiped out by the hand of God. I mean, the story of Noah was a flood that wipes out humanity outside of one family, all God's doing. And so we read of God's people slaughtering 75,000 people as a victory. And then we feel uncomfortable, or some readers might even feel angry or put off. So people, even us, can come to the conclusion that the God of the Bible is so unfair, that he is so wrathful, angry, and bloodthirsty. Like the thought that he would allow, even ordain, the killing of women and innocent children of those who oppose him, that just seems so wrong, like so unjust from a God who is supposed to be just. Why would God create a people to wage war against them? So reading the last parts of Esther, you can see why people would ask these questions, why many people wish the story of Esther ended sooner and didn't end with what this feels like an unnecessary violence and sequel. But the reality of the Bible is that this does indeed happen, and many times, where God demonstrates his wrath upon people. As Karen Jobe says, whether we like it or not, the Old Testament is full of God's violence against the nations who are portrayed as being such evil and sinful people that their destruction is the only remedy. But then does that mean that those who God opposed, like the Persians who fought against the Jews and ended up dying, does it mean that there were no good people among those nations, people who didn't deserve that judgment? Well, Abraham, in Genesis chapter 18, asked the exact same question to God before God planned to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. See, Abraham kept asking God, if there was 50 righteous people, will you spare them? God says, yes, I will spare the city if there are 50. Abraham then bargains, you know, what if there were 45, God? Come on, 45. God says, yes, I will spare the city. Would you spare if there were 40? God says, I will spare if there are 40. Abraham bargains all the way to 10 measly people, and God still agrees that if there were only 10 good people in that whole, in those two cities, he would spare the whole city, which in the end, Abraham could not find. Yet God showed his willingness to withhold destruction and show mercy, even if a handful of God's, of the city's population was deemed righteous. But what the story of Sodom and Gomorrah remind us of is that there are no good people who are undeserving of destruction by their own merit. See, the Old Testament is littered with actions, moments, events, stories of how every human that we read about is sinful. These stories illustrate the New Testament passages that you might have heard of before. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and that the wages of sin is death. We see that play out. Sin and evil in every person ever since Adam and Eve sinned in the garden. To think the Persians, who readers might feel had innocent people, like think about the women, think about the children. They were an empire. They had conquered most of the world, the known world then, with great brutality under King Xerxes. They had swallowed up a heap of the enemies of the Jewish people, and they celebrated that as a nation. Nobody was innocent. Some of the nations that they swallowed up in the Old Testament were nations that opposed God. The nations that opposed God were paid and were made to pay for it. They were involved in things like such as child sacrifice. The entire community was involved in that, women and children included. Nobody was innocent. Even the Israelites, the Jews, God's people in history, they were not chosen because of their righteousness or merit. But they were some of the worst culprits of sin and evil against God in their long-storied history. Them being in Persia in the first place was due to their disobedience to God. They were just the same as their Persian oppressors in that sin and evil was their nature. Yet graciously, they were chosen by God to be agents of his mercy and his will in history. See, from the beginning of creation, God has been at war, not against people, but against evil and sin. As one writer puts it, his violence is not directed against certain races or nations, but against sin and evil wherever it is found. Because a God who is indeed perfect, holy, a God who is righteous and just, is one that can have, who can have no part with sin if he is truly those things. Anything other than righteousness to a righteous God demands justice if God is truly righteous, holy, and just. And so the holy war that God has really been all about ever since Genesis was the one against sin. That God is committed to ending the reign and effects of sin and evil. But being sinful, we as readers seem to want God to destroy evil and sin, but leave people out of it. Like, leave us alone. Like, God, take away all, God, please take away all the bad of the world and just make everything good, but just don't involve us. So people tend to see God as the way atheist Richard Dawkins described, because they think sin and evil are things that are apart from people. So modern readers feel that it's unfair that God would punish people like the Persians or the women and children of the enemies. That surely there were good and righteous people, you know, perhaps 50, perhaps 40, perhaps 10. But the Bible tells us that we can't separate the two. That sin and evil do not exist apart from humans who do evil and do sin. Sin entered the world and has stained everything, particularly humanity, ever since Adam and Eve chose to align themselves against God. And ever since that, what God could only do, being a holy and righteous God, was to pronounce an irrevocable decree of death and destruction against them and all their descendants. That means everybody born after Adam has that decree against them, because all who follow have been opposed to God, sinned against him, disobeyed him, lived unrighteous. As Romans 8 says, that is all of us. God's irrevocable decree of death is against you, me, everyone. And God could have justly done what he did to Sodom and Gomorrah to every single one of us, because there isn't 50, 40, 20, not even 10 of us who are good enough by God's holy standards. But God, in his loving commitment to us, God himself issued a counter decree. A counter decree that will redeem an entire people out of sin and evil and into holiness and righteousness. One where death and destruction is no longer the outcome, but deliverance and delight. Because just like Xerxes, the king, in his decree, he could not simply withdraw his decree of death. God too could not simply withdraw his decree of death after humanity sinned. So God issued his counter decree of life, where Jesus, his son, would be the one who would bring deliverance for those destined for death and destruction. And we can be sure that God simply doesn't revoke the decree of death on humanity, because instead what we read and what we see in the Bible is that God, in his counter decree, takes on that death. With Jesus dying on the cross, bearing the decree of death's punishment on himself, so that those who believe in him may now live in the freedom of the counter decree of life, only made possible by his grace and his worthy sacrifice. See, unlike Esther and Mordecai, Jesus showed his commitment to God's people not by rising the ranks, but lowering himself. From the throne of God, Jesus was, he humbled himself to be made man. Unlike the Jews, who dished out violence and bloodshed to their enemies who opposed them, Jesus showed his commitment to God's people by taking on the violence and bloodshed upon himself. Being mocked, beaten, tortured, and crucified on a cross for his enemies who opposed him. Romans 5 says, "For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son, much more now that we are reconciled, shall we be saved by his life." God's irrevocable decree of death and destruction has been countered by his decree that all those who believe in Jesus and what he has done will not perish but have eternal life. It's because of Jesus. God's war on sin and evil has been won. Jesus, who died on the cross, who 3 days later was raised to life, claims victory over sin and death. In Jesus is the new decree of life. And so it means when we come across chapters, uncomfortable chapters like 8 and 9 here in Esther, we can read through it in the lens of Jesus Christ. It means that when we come across themes such as, or concepts like holy war, we can understand this not as a biblical rationale to continue in this, but read it knowing that Jesus has changed everything. It's no longer an eye for an eye, as Deuteronomy commanded, but as Jesus said in Matthew 5:38, you've heard it was said an eye for an eye, but I say, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also, which is exactly what he did on the cross. It's no longer a reading of God waving his tyrannical power over his enemies to destroy them, but God in his mercy fulfilling his plan for redemption in his Savior Jesus. As Karen Joes puts it so well, all of the vengeance God's people would like to wreak on those who practice evil has now been satisfied in the suffering and death of Jesus. He has taken the wages of sin. He has suffered the vengeance of evil. The vengeance due to us for our sins against others and due to them for their sins against us has been satisfied in Jesus' body on the cross. It's only in our recognizing of what Jesus has done that he has paid the penalty for ours and others' sin and evil, that we can see that true holy war in human history has ceased. As one writer puts it, Jesus has fought its last episode on the cross. We can forgive others because we have been forgiven. And so holy war kind of takes on a new meaning in light of Jesus. You know, it's now the church of Jesus that replaces the army of God's people as the agency God uses to war against sin and evil in this world. But the battlefield is no longer out in the fields or the land, but the human heart where sin resides. I'd like to invite the band up. As Ephesians 6 says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places." And so it is through people coming from the realm of sin and evil to know of life and deliverance in Jesus that the victory is now to be won. See, at the end of chapter 8, upon hearing the counter decree and God's commitment to them, you know what the Jews did? The Jews all around the land further reflected upon what had happened. They rejoiced and they ate and they drank because of the good news. And today, as God's people, we'll get the opportunity to do the same in Holy Communion, remembering Jesus' body broken and his blood shed in death so that we might have life. That is our new decree. But before then, why don't we stand right now? Why don't we sing and give praise to our Savior Jesus, giving glory all to the one who achieved this all for us? Let's sing now.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you'd like to know more about our church, or if you'd like to donate to the work of City on a Hill, please visit cityonahill.com.au.